Hey there, Blake. How are you doing?
I'm cold, Ben, because I don't have a Monster Talk t-shirt.
You know what would be really cool, Blake, would be if
a
there was
a Monster Talk t-shirt.
Yes, that's just what I was thinking. Why don't we have somebody design a t-shirt, Blake?
But Ben, who could we ask?
I don't know. Let me think. Dun, dun. Hey, I have an idea, Blake. Why don't we hold a contest and we'll have our listeners, many of whom are very creative and, frankly, much better artists and are smarter than we are, and ask them to submit some designs for our super cool, awesome Monster Talk t-shirt.
I like this idea, but how can we properly incentivize our listeners to participate?
That's a great question, Blake. Let me think. Hey, I know. Maybe we could offer prizes for first, second, and third place designs. And, of course, the grand prize, the best one, will be put on a Monster Talk t-shirt. What do you think of that, Blake?
I think we should use the losers, too.
I think that's a great idea. Well, why don't we do this? Why don't we have an official Monster Talk t-shirt contest challenge thingy? We'll have, like, the deadline be the end of the year.
The 2012 Monster Talk t-shirt contest thingy. Submit your designs to contest at monstertalk.org. Deadline for entries December 31st, 2011. Winners to be selected in January.
Chances are they're not what you think they are. All your life you've been shown images of genies as powerful, magical entities which have, through one method or another, been trapped in a lamp or a ring and are forced to do the bidding of anyone who possesses such items. But those so-called genies have about as much to do with traditional jinn of Arabic folklore as Casper the Friendly Ghost has to do with The Shining. Here's the most important difference between the genie from pop culture and the creatures called djinn. Many people all over the world believe that djinn are real, often malevolent creatures which are responsible for hauntings and possession. They fit the cultural niche that ghosts and demons fill in Western culture and are generally not at all the sort of creature you'd want to let out of a bottle or encounter in a desolate valley or an abandoned home. And while they inspired I Dream of Genie and Disney's Aladdin, they also fueled the writings of H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard. So sit back and prepare to uncork a bottle of gin on this episode of Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford, we're going to chat with author Robert Lebling about his new book, Legends of the Fire Spirits. It's a very comprehensive book about the folklore surrounding creatures known as djinn. Of course, Ben and I are skeptics, and Lebling's book presents the legends, folklore, and modern anecdotes from a neutral stance. He's living in Saudi Arabia in a culture where these entities are not only believed by the public, but also endorsed by the Quran and by Islam. Listeners to Monster Talk will recognize that I have an affinity for tales of the paranormal and the supernatural, and so do my co-hosts. If you're into that sort of thing, I think you'll find Lebling's book a fascinating read. We don't have him on to debate the existence of these entities, but to talk about the legends. Some of the tales of djinn will describe phenomena similar to a haunting, others to possession, yet others to fairy tales and folk tales and even alien abduction stories. All of these classes of phenomena are familiar to skeptical paranormal enthusiasts, but it's fascinating to hear these same kinds of experiences attributed to an entirely different entity.
I find that interesting as a skeptic and as an enthusiast of anthropology and psychology. I suspect you will too if you give his book a read. Let's get to our interview with Robert Lebling right now.
Monster Talk.
What led you to become interested in Jinn?
I suppose my interest in the Middle East probably led to that. I'm interested in anthropology. I did some study in college and started to hear stories over here in Saudi Arabia and other countries in the region. And I became interested in finding out what was behind the stories. So I did start to do research into it, and I got access to a very good library of old material and new material. And from there, I decided I ought to start my own Yahoo group and start chatting with people about it. And before you know it, the Jinn group was born, and from that I started collecting material over the years. It's been, this goes back to the 1990s, because I've been here since 94 in Saudi Arabia, and it's now, it's just one of those things that it's kind of hard to shake. So I've been, you know, I decided eventually the material I collected was worth putting into a book, and after working on it through a number of iterations with my editor at IB Taurus, we finally found something that we thought would work, a narrative history. And so that's where we are. We've told what we think is the origins and the the scope of the Jinn phenomenon around the world, primarily in the Muslim and Arabic-speaking world. I don't know. There's more. I've collected so much material over the years about other supernatural phenomena, spirit creatures, and the like, that I may spin those into another book at another time, drawing in and discussing the parallels between the genie or the jinn phenomenon and those of other countries, for example, a Celtic tradition, the elves and fairies, and so forth. China and so forth.
I was going to say, I've read your book, of course, Legends of the Fire Spirits, and I have to say I really enjoyed it. It had such good, rich historical context and anthropological context. It was fascinating to me to read an account of Jinn that was in-depth and scholarly, because a lot of the stuff that I'd read about, because, you know, this is one of my interests. And so much of it was just sort of superficial, you know, mentions in passing. And I was struck by the research that went into it. Can you talk a little bit about that research?
Well, I started collecting stories and talking to people in Saudi Arabia, particularly about how they perceive the jinn. It's a question of perception, clearly, and of explanation. How do you explain phenomena that are puzzling and perhaps don't fit into the normal experiences of your life? The people of the Middle East and the greater Islamic world believe firmly that jinn are real creatures. They are this comes primarily from the passages in the Quran, the holy book of Islam, that verify the existence of genies for Muslims. You know, for us in the West, it's an alien concept, but there were things about it that seemed similar to phenomena that I was seeing in other countries. And I was also interested in comparing how the jinn behaved with the alien phenomenon in mm-hmm. in the United States, alien abductions and so forth. In the Middle East, the jinn do the same kind of abducting as aliens in Western culture are said to do. And so I thought there might be some parallels here and things worth exploring. And I started digging deeper into the material, and before you knew it, I'd come up with a plan, and I put it down on paper and moved from there.
Mm-hmm.
The people that I know in Saudi Arabia who believe in the jinn phenomenon are very reasonable, ordinary folk. And the fact that they take this so seriously indicates to me that I should at least try to understand where they're coming from. And that's what the book is about, an attempt to understand how people can believe in a phenomenon like this, and what does it mean for them, and does it have more meaning than simply a fireside story? Is it more than something to scare kids with in the evenings, or is there something to it that is deeply embedded in human nature? And I think there is. I really do. I think that the belief in jinn here, I've compared it among a number of societies, and in some cases, I mean, it takes a while to get into the jinn phenomenon, but there are evil jinn and good jinn. There are the jinn are a creature of a sentient being with the ability to distinguish right from wrong, the ability to act on free will and make choices, and some of them end up being believers in God or a higher power. Can be any religion. Others reject religion and yet are inextricably linked with it because they associate themselves with the devil. And you have the evil jinn, they fall into several categories. You've got the ifrit. You got a lesser category called the shaitans, which simply means the satans, like demons. Then there are the ifrit, which are often larger and more frightening than the shaitans. And then you have the marids, which are the largest and most powerful of all jinn. And all these beliefs in evil jinns are balanced by a belief that there are good jinn. Some of them become partners of people and protect them. Some of them protect houses, like the old Roman concept of the genii or the genius, a household deity. And so we have all these kinds of things going on at the same time, and it's kind of interesting to try and separate them out and figure out, you know, why somebody believes in this sort of thing and why and to what extent it's it prevails. I mean, you'll find some people who will tell you that they think these are all fairy stories or the like, that they're not really true, and then mm-hmm. and yet you will find that these same people are will be frightened to go into an empty house for fear of disturbing the jinn. And also they'll use religious formulas to protect them from the jinn under many, many circumstances.
So how seriously are the jinn taken? I mean, as you said, some people believe in them and others don't. Is it a case of where all good Muslims necessarily believe in the existence of jinn? Or is it a case, for example, I mean, one analogy that I got from the book was, in some ways you might compare jinn to demons or angels, probably demons, in the Bible, where, you know, not all Christians necessarily literally believe in the existence of angels, but many of them do.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is right. If you talk to a westernized a Muslim in this part of the world, they'll often tell you that there may perhaps be a metaphorical explanation for the jinn. There are some interpretations that say jinn could be simply bad people or unusual people. There are some who feel that who don't accept the concept at all. I mean, you have a complete spectrum of people. The more religious the people are, the more they tend to believe in it. And the more traditional they are, the more they tend to believe in it. And we have a lot of traditional people here in Saudi Arabia, and they tend to accept it. In fact, the government of Saudi Arabia is very very opposed to the notion of black magic, which would be the kind of sorcery or magic that summons jinn to do your bidding. That can be a criminal offense here. In fact, in some cases, you can be sentenced to death for it, which indicates that they believe it's not simply a case of fraud, but of a person trying to defraud someone by claiming that they have access to the jinn and can tap their powers, but rather that they that indeed it is a real threat, and it is a threat to goodness and religious belief. So
how is the Arabian jinn concept different from like the westernized version of the genie in the bottle?
Well, that's pretty much entertainment, and you do find that in the culture here. If you go back to the Arabian Nights tales, there are a number of those. There are genies in bottles, but they're only a small. Small fraction of jinn belief, and it really is purely for entertainment. The storytellers will tell stories about jinn who have these powers, and that you can call on them to do things for you. But in terms of day-to-day life, nobody here expects to come across a bottle with a genie in it on the beach. What they think will happen is they might encounter jinn in remote places, places that are desolate, ruins, archaeological ruins, for example, sewers, dark places, caves.
You mentioned that. That was actually one of my questions was, it seems like jinn, they inhabit abandoned places in that way. In that particular way, they sort of fulfill the same niche as ghosts do here in the U.S. For
yes.
People. It's a haunted thing. It haunts ruined places. Is there more belief in jinn than ghosts in Saudi Arabia or in the Middle East?
They don't. There isn't a belief in ghosts as we know it.
Okay.
Ghosts being spirits of the dead. At least I haven't come across it. Anytime someone will tell you that an abandoned old building is haunted, it's haunted by jinn. And jinn are not considered to be the spirits of the dead. They are a separate species of being, an intelligent being that lives on earth with man. In fact, lives in other places as well, perhaps in another dimension. Perhaps since they're invisible, frequently it's hard to tell where they hang out, but there are stories about that. But the jinn have the ability to pass from invisibility to visibility, and they do that through means that we can't explain. And there are some people, I think my book indicates, some people who've tried to speculate as to whether perhaps the jinn are visible in spectra that we can't see, the infrared or the ultraviolet. Infrared generally for jinn and ultraviolet for angels is the way that people in this part of the world look at it. Anyone who tries to find a scientific explanation for these creatures. But they live, they guard treasure. They live in abandoned places. And yet at the same time, the jinn are known as a tribal people. They are said to live to have families and like human beings, and tribal groups, clans. There have been stories of them doing the pilgrimage to Mecca by camel caravan. People encountering them in the desert. So there are, they have a whole range of actions and experiences that go a little bit beyond haunting. They also seem to have the ability to possess human beings, much as a demon would in the Western tradition, the exorcist kind of thing. And there are people in this country and in others in the area, religiously oriented people, religious scholars and so forth who specialize in helping to exorcise demons from afflicted people. This gets into the area of psychology, of course. And some people, there are cases of people who have gone through psychiatric treatment without benefit and then went to a religious leader and were exorcised and were cured. Of course, there are probably many cases where the where that doesn't happen, but there people will do talk about that. Mm-hmm. So you have possession as one another aspect, well, you have a whole lot of things. The origin of jinn, they go way back. I mean, this is not something that, that started with Islam, even though the Islamic faith confirmed the existence of jinn, as the people here would say. They go back at least as far as the ancient Sumerians, and there were a number of one would consider them early deities, perhaps nature spirits, wind gods, and that sort of thing, who eventually became jinn. And you hear about the demon of the Exorcist, the movie, and the book
was Pazuzu, right?
Pazuzu. Yeah, Pazuzu. Yeah.
Now, Pazuzu is thought to be an early jinn form. He comes out of the Pazuzu comes out of the hot desert wind, and that is one interpretation of how the jinn are born or created. Generally, people here believe that they're created from smokeless fire. That God originally created them from smokeless fire, like He is supposed to have created man out of clay. Mm-hmm. But they, there are some who believe that that the jinn actually come from hot desert, the scorching desert wind. But for the purposes of my book, that when I call them fire spirits, I'm referring to that origin. Not that they have any connection with fire now, just as humans would not be considered to be clay creatures, but it simply identifies their origin in the views of most people in this part of the world.
Getting back to you're talking about how it was originally associated with the winds and stuff, it struck me reading the book that in many ways the jinn come from a long tradition of blaming sort of the supernatural or natural other for bad things that happened. You know, you have droughts, you have sandstorms, you have bad areas or areas where wise travelers either don't go or tread very lightly. And it seems like the jinn reside in those places. And so in some ways, it seems like the jinn are used, as other monsters are throughout the world as well, as sort of a boogeyman. You know, watch out. You know, if you don't stray too far off the path because, you know, bad things will happen to you. And you also talk, for example, about how jinn are said to appear in the form of snakes, and that there's a prohibition against killing snakes because, well, don't kill a snake, because if it turns out to be a jinn, you're going to be in bad trouble. So it's sort of again, sort of the social control aspect of jinn. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, that's they can take the form of many things. Snakes is one of the most common, but the fact that the number of stories in Islamic lore about people who have killed snakes and have been punished for it, either gone before jinn courts or been put to death or by spirits, or there are lots of ways that they could take revenge. But the idea of in Islam is that if you have a doubt as to whether a creature is actually a jinn, if you see an animal and you think it perhaps is a jinn, you use a religious formula. You recite a religious formula to determine if that's the case. What they call the Bismillah, or in the name of God, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the compassionate and merciful. If you say something like that, and there are a number of other formulas, but that's the most common, the jinn will flee from you. and you won't have to worry about having to kill them. In the case of a snake, it would leave you, or even insects in your house, if they happen to be jinn, and you recited one of these formulas, then they would leave you.
Oh, wow. Let's go see. That's very similar to the way that Christians often deal with demonic forces, is an incantation, a Hail Mary, that sort of thing.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And what you were saying about the forces of nature is actually, I think, pretty close to the case in some respects. Certainly there are all kinds of environmental hazards in this part of the world that can be explained by the intervention of supernatural creatures, and I think that probably is the case. But there are also other explanations that are not related to nature, and so we have all kinds here. The animal thing is interesting. Shape shifting seems to be one of the characteristics, the most common characteristics of jinn. Why they would take one shape rather than another hasn't really been well explained to people. But you do see them in just about every animal form except the wolf. And that is kind of mysterious, but there is apparently the jinn cannot or will not emulate a wolf for some reason. There is a jinn creature in Yemen that does take the form of a wolf, and that's the sort of the exception that proves the rule. It's something called the Udrut, and it appears on the scene when someone has been killed and there is blood, when there is some sort of a violent act and there is a dead person. The Udrut creature, as a wolf, will come and lurk and scare people, but it never does anything. I mean, it never attacks anyone. It's just a visible presence. That's the only time that I've ever come across jinn in the form of wolves, and that's only in southern Arabia. In the other parts of Arabia, the jinn would never take the form of a wolf.
So is the scope of the influence of jinn tied to Islamic culture, or is it tied to North Africa, or how do you think that plays out? Because I know there's a lot of shape-shifting beliefs in sort of shamanistic parts of Africa, but I don't remember in Southern Africa, for example, hearing about jinn. I don't remember that coming up.
Yeah, you do have the jinn in certain parts of Africa, mostly ones where the influence of Islamic culture is strong, particularly areas where Arab traders came through, but also in Nigeria, up near the Sahara, where the influence came across the desert from the Berbers, the Tuaregs, and other nomadic people. But North Africa has its own; they have its own twist. The North Africans have their own twist on jinn belief. Some of it's really interesting. There's the famous character, a woman who is like a Lilith figure. In the book, we talk about Lilith as being not only a creature of Jewish lore, an ancient Jewish lore, but also of Arabic lore, and also pre-Islamic Arabic lore, because the ancient Babylonians had a Lilith figure, which would be a female that seduces men and wreaks havoc on babies and does a number of things, very antisocial things that result from how that legend developed. The Lilith creature, in fact, Lilith is sometimes viewed in the Babylonian tradition as a vampire, which may be, I mean, there are some Middle Eastern parallels to some of our famous Western monsters, and that may be one. But this Aisha Kandisha character in Morocco and Algeria, to a limited extent Tunisia, is a very powerful force. This is like It's along the lines of the incubus or succubus.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
That seduces men, particularly, well, not just single men, but they seem to be often victimized, but also married men, because the tradition is, of course, that Lilith or Aisha, Kandisha, was rebuffed by, well, left Adam. Actually, she made the choice to leave Adam because of her unwillingness to accept his domination during sexual relations, because she wanted to be on top, basically. And that belief that she, in leaving Adam, was filled with rage and went to the Red Sea and mated with a number of demons and produced all kinds of jinn, evil jinn particularly. This character, this Lilith character, is in North Africa, is named Aisha Kandisha, and she is. There's even a band that's named after her. It's quite interesting how powerful that influence is. You also find in Tunisia some strange stuff. They have jinn of the land, sea, and air, and this is probably the only place where you'll really see an in-depth portrayal of jinn as aquatic creatures. They're sort of like mer creatures, mermen and mermaids. So that's really interesting. But it comes out of the fact that Tunisia is a strong merchant tradition, and this is the site of ancient Carthage and so forth. And that belief goes back at least as far as the Carthaginians.
You mentioned the historical character of Lilith. If I'm not mistaken, King Solomon is also supposed to have a connection to jinn. Can you talk about that?
Yes, King Solomon. It's funny. This time of year in Saudi Arabia, when you're walking in an area where there are trees and some grass, you'll often see a bird called the hoopoe. It's a rather colorful, but it's a light brown bird with black stripes on it and a tuft on its head. It's really a striking looking bird. You see a lot of them this time of year, and this was a bird that is very famous in ancient lore. In Arabic, it's called the hudhud, H-U-D-H-U-D. And it's also very important in Jewish lore. The hoopoe brought to King Solomon in Jerusalem word of the Queen of Sheba, the first time he ever heard of her. Sheba is supposed to be ancient Saba, which is down in the corner of Arabia in Yemen. And she is supposed to be half jinn. I'm trying to think now whether it was her mother or her father, but I don't know which one was supposed to be of jinn origin. And the hoopoe told Solomon, because Solomon had the ability from God to communicate with animals and jinn, told Solomon that this beautiful queen was down in Saba, and that he really ought to check her out. So he invited her to come up to Jerusalem, and then the rich lore of Solomon and Sheba followed out of that. In fact, he even at one point wanted to find out whether she had jinn characteristics, and Solomon is said to have created a fake pond in one of his palaces, a pond that looked like water but was actually glass, and invited the Queen of Sheba, who she was known in Arabic tradition as Bilqis, asked her to walk across it. It was very shallow, of course, it seemed, and she did, and she lifted her skirts, and he wanted to catch a look at her legs to see if she was could possibly be a jinn based on her legs. Some people said that they had hairy legs or even goat feet. These beliefs, of course, they vary depending on where the story comes from. But there is the outcome of that particular incident has been kept secret from all of us, so we don't know exactly what Solomon saw. But Solomon, he did have the ability to control the jinn based on a ring that God gave him. This magic ring, which had the seal of Solomon on it, which is essentially the Star of David. This ring has been lost to history, if it ever existed, but it was said to have the power to make evil jinn do his bidding, and they in effect became his servants and built a number of palaces and castles throughout the Middle East on Solomon's behalf. There are a number of other stories that talk about these jinn when some of them got free, and you know what happened there. There's some good stories in the Arabian Nights in relation to this. Some of them are tied in with some very old history from Al Andalus or Islamic Spain, in connection with something called the City of Brass. There was said to be in the Sahara somewhere a city built of brass, and one of the governors of Al-Andalus, at the request of the caliph in Damascus, went on an expedition into the desert to find the city. And in the process, he found the city, but he also found somewhere near the sea a collection of sometimes described as casks, sometimes as other types of containers. That were at the bottom of the sea, and they were said to contain jinn, and he had them brought out by divers and placed on the shore and opened, and as he opened them, the jinn who were in these casks flew out rapidly into the sky and expressed great fear of Solomon. They thought Solomon was still alive, and they fled from him because he had put them in these boxes many, many years ago, according to tradition.
Would you say that fear of Solomon is their generic response?
Oh. Yes, they are definitely generically frightened by Solomon. He was the guy with the power. And that's why there have been some people who have looked for that ring of power that he had and tried to figure out where it could have been. Of course, that assumes that the story is true. But all we know is that it's a great story. And there are a number of castles and structures in various parts of the Middle East. And this one that I mentioned in the Sahara was supposed to have been built by Solomon, too, with jinn laborers. The story of Solomon is grander than the reality, obviously, and the extent of his empire was immense, according to the ancient belief. This is the same as Alexander the Great, of course, who was dramatized even more, I think, in the romances of Alexander the Great. I don't have any good jinn stories about
them. There's a lot of stories about them doing miraculous things, but then there's the more sinister side about abduction. So why do you think they're reported to abduct children? What is that all about?
I don't know. I don't know what it's about.
Okay.
I think it's basically it's an explanation, you know, for having a child that doesn't appear to be the child of the parents. It's one way
to explain it. The changeling story.
It's the changeling.
Okay.
And, you know, you see that sometimes, and who else could have taken the child but the jinn and substituted one of their own, who is obviously not from our family. I don't know really. But there are abductions of adults as well that take place. In some cases, people that live many years with the jinn. Some of them eventually escape. There was, I remember reading one. There's a story in the book about this. There's one guy who was, I think he spent 7 years with the jinn, and he finally escaped when he came across some rue, which is a plant that the jinn hate, and was told to stay away from it, that they hated it, and because they had him, he was out in the wilderness with the djinn. And the by running toward that roux and grabbing it and holding it to himself, he managed to frighten the djinn away, so he was able to go home to his family. But there are cases where people are captured by them and I guess enslaved by them. But that any kind of story you can imagine probably has been told somewhere in the Middle East about the djinn. I think they cover a multitude of sins.
I was going to ask one thing that intrigued me about the book and your discussion of djinn was that they not only can they take basically any form they want, primarily of course animals, but of course they can look exactly like us. And your book talks about people who believe or sort of suspect that they may have encountered djinn previously, people who either did bad things to them or did good things to them, in a couple cases doing favors for them. Assuming that djinn exist, and that's a big assumption, but assuming they exist, how would we know who's a djinn and who's not? I mean, if they can act like us, if they can get married, if they have kids, if they have jobs and religions and faiths, and if in just about every other way they can be exactly identical to us, our doppelgangers,
yes.
how do we tell them apart?
We can't. That they can duplicate people and act just like them. And if they're not doing it for evil purposes, there's no way you can tell. If they are doing it for evil purposes, you can use religion to expose them, because the evil djinn fear the word of God, according to tradition. And you can use the formulas to sort of like garlic, to bring them out, as you might with a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are probably cases, and you read about them in lore of people who are djinn and go many years without being detected, but generally something, they slip up, or in their cases where, or they are somehow detected, but generally they can do it for quite some time and you wouldn't know. And you see modern examples of this in the book, where there's a girl, a Bangladeshi girl, who is talking about a girlfriend of hers who that she's convinced is a jinnia, or a female jinn. But there are, and she didn't realize it at first, but people. Then they conclude after seeing certain behaviors that these people are djinn.
So often sort of a retrospective diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, it's an explanation. How do you explain some bizarre behavior? How do you explain anything? Well, you draw upon your traditions, and this is where the djinn come in. And they're, I'm trying to think of some interesting examples of that for you, but I...
Well, they can read the book, right?
I think that's what it's for. I mean, basically, I'm not trying to persuade anyone of anything in this book. I just want to open them up to the tradition and let people look at it and enjoy it, because I think there's some interesting and amusing and scary stuff to be learned from it.
Well, and for a lot of us, even people who read up on monsters and the supernatural a lot, just because we live in a westernized world, we aren't able to be exposed so easily to some of the folklore and cultures from other parts of the world. So this is a great thing for you to put that out.
Thanks. Sometimes I want to do some more writing on the connections between our traditions and the people here in the Middle East, because I've found some interesting connections of some of our monsters from the European tradition. And I was just doing some study of one of the monsters that's well known in the West, even though it isn't a European phenomenon. That's the zombie. It's very popular today. It originally comes out of a Haitian tradition and from before Haiti came out of sub-Saharan Africa, but the zombie as we see it today in modern folklore, which you'd have to say includes motion pictures, is quite different from the zombie of Haiti or New Orleans, even. The zombie that we see in George Romero's The Night of the Living Dead is actually a bloodthirsty, flesh-eating creature. And I've seen a fairly recent study of George Romero's work, and he's a real pioneer in the modern zombie. It says that he actually borrowed that concept from the Middle East, from the ghoul. The ghoul is a flesh-eating monster. It's a jinn origin, and when you think about it, it ties in very well with Night of the Living Dead.
And my next question was going to be: you cover ghouls quite a lot. What is the relationship between the ghoul and the jinn?
Well, it's kind of a specialized jinn. It's an evil one. It doesn't fit into the major categories. When I said the shaitan and the ifrit and the mar, it doesn't fit into those, or into the run-of-the-mill jinn, which would be either just the jinn as we know it, or the jann, which is the collective of all these creatures. They call them jann, J-A-N-N. But the ghoul is a particularly frightening example. It's almost universally believed to be a jinn. However, I'm sure there are some, you'll find some people say, no, it isn't. But it is a monster that is said to inhabit caves and remote places that will trick you. Often it's a female, often called a ghoula. And the ghoula will first present itself as being very beautiful and then suddenly reveal its frightening appearance. It's a large, hairy, ugly beast, and it loves to eat human flesh. And there's some wonderful stories out of Yemen on this. There was a guy, King Saif, who was one of the kings of Yemen, who ends up going to he gets in effect dropped into a valley of the ghouls, and is stuck there and trying to figure out how to survive, because he knows that this valley in Yemen is filled with these evil ghouls. So he goes up into a tree and to spend the night. And when he wakes up in the morning, the tree is surrounded by these monsters that just want to eat him, and they can smell him like the Jack and the Beanstalk giant, you know, fee, fi, fo, fum. They know they can smell human flesh and human blood, and they were around the tree ready to chomp on him. He eventually gets out of this by cutting a deal with the queen of the ghouls, and it's a long story, but he's a hero, so he gets to escape. But these kind of things, the ghouls are, those legends still exist in Egypt. They're very popular in Egypt. I haven't heard a lot of that in Saudi Arabia, but as I said, Yemen is a rich territory for the ghoul as well.
Well, do you read H.P. Lovecraft or Robert E. Howard?
Sure.
Yeah, I was going to say it's interesting how especially Howard's work ties in the sort of Arabic jinn and the sort of take on the Celtic little people. And Arthur Machen's take on the little people as not something that's just a fairy tale, but something that's really horrible and frightening. Howard sort of formed that nexus within fiction of tying that folklore together really neatly. So,
yeah, I agree. It's very, very interesting. And a lot of this stuff that comes out of the Middle East has been integrated into Western literature, and I think that's one of the reasons I got interested in it. I came into it sort of through the back door and then realized, oh, this is the Middle East. I mean, they're all talking about this area where I live. And I was happy to be able to do the research to find out more about this. And this is something that I think people around the world can enjoy, particularly as literature. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting gin-related tales that people can grab onto if they are of a mind to. If you're tired of the old monsters, try some of these. They're even older, but they look a little newer because you haven't seen them much.
Yeah,
they're sort of a new
variation, new twist on a lot of what people think. That's one of the things that that surprised me, frankly, about your book was that, you know, I knew it was about genies and gin, but then all of a sudden we're talking about ghouls, and we're talking about urban legends, we're talking about succubi, and it was interesting to sort of see how there's all these tangential monsters and creatures that are actually trace their roots back to gin and certainly have common roots. Let me ask about, you talked about one version of it, seducing men. So people believe that you can have sex with gin. What do the gin experts say? I mean, is it, are there people who...
There's a lot of dispute over that it is not, it's not 100%. If you ask an Islamic scholar, he could come up with one answer or the other. There are a number of them who say, oh, yes, it's purely normal and natural for these two different species to have relations, sexual relations. Others will say, no, it's impossible. And I think I referred to both of these traditions. But the more interesting one is where the two species can interact in that way. And there's, I think on the popular level, it's more accepted than the one that says that they can't have relations. It's accepted because it's more interesting, it's more tantalizing, and it also, some of it ties in with these, I don't know, there's an awful lot of, heavy symbolism involved in all of this stuff the gin stuff. And one of the things I'm thinking of an example would be the Palestinians who have had relations with gin who were Jewish gin, had sexual relations with them. So, I mean, it's sort of like trying to solve the Middle East conflict through bizarre monsters. I don't know. It's kind of
really
unusual. But there, I mean, if you read up on the psychiatric literature in Israel, there's a lot on this. The Israeli psychologists and psychiatrists have taken great interest in the belief in the jinn and their connections with the political situation. And generally, it's the Palestinians who are the ones who are most affected by the jinn phenomenon there. Most of the Israelis are pretty westernized or modern in their perspective.
As Islam has spread, have the jinn spread as well? I mean, so like, is American people, would they expect, American Islamic people, would they expect to see a jinn instead of a ghost in the house? You know what I mean? I mean, is it folklore? It's carried over?
It carries over. And there are cases of jinn possession and jinn activity in the States. I've been collecting this kind of lore for a long time and only could put a fraction of it in this book. But there are a lot of news stories. You'd be surprised how many times the jinn pop up in places where they're not expected. One of them is in the United States, and it's been involved in jinn belief is tied in with the terrorism issue. There were cases of people who are associated with terrorist groups who were believers in jinn, and I think you saw some of that in Iraq as well. There were people who were saying that Saddam Hussein had made a pact with the jinn. It looks like they didn't keep their side of the bargain.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because earlier this year there was actually a story that came out that Ahmadinejad of Iran His foes and I think people in his cabinet were accused of using gin and using for their own purposes. So it's fascinating to me, again, to sort of see the way that this ancient tradition can be sort of rebottled and respun and used for political purposes and sort of, you know, so just dust it off. Do you think that's going to continue, or what do you, why is that such an effective, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Do you think that is an effective strategy? And if so, why?
Well, I don't think it gets as far as it might have in the old days. I know that issue did come up, but I think it also died down pretty fast. So I don't think it was as effective a tool, particularly in those among those people who are not extremely traditional. Now you have someone like Ahmadinejad he's a mixture, you know, and he comes out of a tradition that's very very supportive of the jinn, but at the same time he's tried to distance himself from some of the religious leaders who support that kind of thing. So I don't know. I think you're going to see more of it, particularly in developing countries, more jinn references as political excuses. You'll see, I think we've seen that in, we've seen it in certain countries in Africa. I think we saw it in Afghanistan. But this is, I don't think it's something that's on the rise, because the belief in the jinn, I don't think is necessarily on the rise. I think it's reached a sort of a stabilized level, and will, if anything, will be declining as time goes on.
So, how would one distinguish a jinn from some other supernatural entity? What kind of powers did they have that make them unique?
No, different jinn have different powers. They have the power to enter a human body, which is one thing. They have the power to fly. Many jinn have been known to fly great distances in very very short amount of time, this is Solomon and others used this ability for reconnaissance, that they would find out about what was going on in a neighboring country by sending jinn off. There are depends on again on what type of jinn there are. Some of them have the ability to speak through human beings. When they possess, they can take over the. In addition to controlling they control the body and the mind, apparently, because they're able to speak through the person and say what they want to be said. I think then you got jinn that are just they're just living their lives, and they're not trying to perform tricks or exert powers over people. I've talked to people who've actually said they were jinn. You can never. These are actually remote contacts by email, and have no validity scientifically, but. People who were actually Saudi and said they were jinn and described in great detail the kinds of lives they led and where they came from, where they went to school, and what their tribe was like. And
did you notice which internet service provider the jinn preferred?
No. I think wherever there is email, there are jinn.
At least in Western culture, the jinn are really famous for having these really tricky contracts. Like, in order to get them to do something for you, you have to be very specific in how you word it. And the sort of conflict between that kind of contract mind and the people who do internet service providers contracts.
No, that's clever.
It could be tight.
Yeah, it really could. But I, for the most part, jinn are not going to do you any favors. You can count on that. And if they're forced to, they will. But you're going to have to find a way to compel them, and that's where the problem lies. That's
Let me ask you about that, because the first time that I really investigated gin was in Africa in 2007 when I was in Zanzibar off the coast of Tanzania. And I was looking into a mysterious creature called the Popobawa, which is means bat wing or bat foot. And it's this sort of combination of gin, ghost, vampire creature. And I interviewed locals about the monster, and some people believed – a lot of them didn't believe in it at all. They just thought it was just sort of a piece of folklore. But many of them did. And what really interested me was that when I asked them, well, what do you think the nature of this creature is, oftentimes the explanation was that it was a gin. It was not only was a gin, but it was basically a gin that had escaped its master. And I was told that there were, for lack of a better word, wizards or witch doctors who lived near Zanzibar, maybe in Pemba or in the Comoros Islands, that could control jinn. And you talked a little bit about that with like the Seal of Solomon. But I guess I have two questions. One is, how would a modern day wizard either capture and or control a jinn? And number two, how do modern Muslims sort of reconcile the belief? And again, you sort of touched on this earlier, but how do they go about their daily lives thinking that there is an evil jinn that's doing bad things in their midst?
Wizards use spells. And there are spell books, medieval spell books, that teach you how to do this sort of thing, how to control the jinn. I haven't seen any of these. I've just read about them. I did have an offer to see a translation of one at one time from a Pakistani graduate student who said he was going to try out some of these spells. Unfortunately, he had a very bad experience and only shared a little bit of it, but he insisted that it worked and that it left his apartment scorched black on the walls, and that he never wanted to do this again. So this is not an area where, particularly in Saudi Arabia, you don't get into this sort of thing in any great detail. It's considered black magic or what they call the condemned system. Sorcery is not legal in Saudi Arabia. However, there are people around the Islamic world who practice this, and we all know that that's the case. And they use spells, and I would venture to say that most of them are very ancient Arabic grimoires, basically. And these books are out there. Some of them are accessible. Whether they work or not, I can't say.
Well put.
So we have to ask everybody who comes on our show, we try to ask them, what is your favorite monster?
My favorite monster. I would have to say... Pazuzu the demon. I would say he's the best.
That's a good one. A lot of people like that. Yeah.
Simply because I really enjoyed The Exorcist, and I didn't realize that it actually had an actual basis in one of the Middle Eastern demons. So
it's a film that turned a lot of heads.
And I've spent a lot of time in Georgetown where they did some of that shooting. The filming of that movie. So,
yeah, my niece is at Georgetown now, so I want to go visit at some point and get a picture of the staircase. So
you have to,
yeah,
you have to go.
Well, I want to say, Robert, thank you so much for being on the show. Your book's very interesting, and we'll put a link to it in our show notes.
Yeah, good job on that. It's a really fine piece of work, and I would consider it essentially the definitive book on gin. I know there are others out there, but this is certainly the most recent, and I think the most thorough. And it just does a great job. So good job on that.
Thank you. I'd point out one thing, before we go, this being the end of Ramadan, during the month of Ramadan, the gin are imprisoned by God, and they're all chained, and they can't do all the evil that they normally do. This is God's way of cutting a break for mankind. But Ramadan's over, so they're on the loose again.
Uh-oh.
Better be careful.
At least you can have something to eat while you ponder how to handle that, right?
I can't wait.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You've been listening to Blake Smith and Ben Radford interview author Robert Lebling about his book, Legends of the Fire Spirits, which is all about the Arabic tales of jinn, genie, and ghouls. A link to his book is in the show notes. If you've enjoyed Monster Talk, I hope you'll consider donating a buck or two to our transcription project. Thanks to listeners like Gerko Balintian, Robert Smith, James F. Stein, Katie Alvarado, Brian Beaton, John St. Clair, Shane Brady, and David Rodriguez, we've managed to get 6 episodes ordered up for transcription so far. Having the transcripts helps in several ways. It helps Google searchers find us, it helps people reference our content in Wikipedia, and it will be vital for my upcoming YouTube project, which I'm planning for the show. It costs between $60 and $70 to get an episode transcribed, so even just a few dollars is very helpful. And thanks to everyone who's given so far. We really appreciate it. If you want to meet other listeners to Monster Talk, come join our Facebook group. It's free, and there's a lot of fun content posted there. You can find it by searching Monster Talk on Facebook, or come to monstertalk.org, and you'll find links to the Facebook page, as well as contact info for all the hosts, and links to our Twitter feed and other content. Monster Talk is produced with the help of Skeptic Magazine. Thanks, Skeptic Magazine! Music for today's episode included Arabian Landscape by Guardian Mind Mix. And as always, our theme music's by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you again for listening.
Skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
It makes sense that they would be communicating with telephones because they could be locked in with Solomon's ringtone.
Ah. that would have tremendous power if we could duplicate Solomon's ringtone.
I'll promise, Ben, I'll take these jokes out and post.